Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is author Reed Mittenbuehler, And we're talking about his latest book. I tell you, I haven't enjoyed a book more in months. Wild Minds, The Artists and Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation. Reed, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
As a person who has spent a large part of his adult life teaching the history of animation, I have to say this is a fantastic book. What sort of prompted you to write it?
You know, as a kid growing up in the 80s, early 90s, I watched cartoons the same as any other kid, right? You know, Saturday mornings, and always had thought of them as something aimed directly at me as a child. And it wasn't until I became older, as an adult, I came across, you know, some old Looney Tunes, was rewatching them, and I realized there were a lot of jokes that had been over my head as a kid. And I was actually laughing at it far more as an adult than I ever had as a kid. So I kind of got curious. I had started to dig. And once you start to dig, all of these stories come up about the names that aren't as obvious, like the Fleischer brothers, the creators behind Popeye and Betty Boop. And you start seeing these personalities in an industry they built, and it's very different than we remember it as today. I mean, there's a sea change in the 50s when it did become more geared towards children.
But those and I want to say that your history actually deals with that time period, and I found that fascinating. I'd actually like to do a whole separate interview with you just on that time period.
Oh, great, yeah.
Well, let's start talking about one of the great early animators, at which there is a number, and you do a great job of it, Winsor McKay. I've always admired his comic art for the Sunday newspapers, but he was also an animator.
Right, not only an animator, he's almost kind of the patron saint of animation. I mean, in the very early days, it really didn't even exist. Only a couple people had kind of experimented with this idea of making your cartoons move on a screen. This is in the first decade of the 20th century. So he basically created the art form in a lot of ways and was an inspiration to all the big names, including Disney, that came after him. And, you know, did it at a level that was so advanced right out of the gate. It was really amazing. And it was a side gig. I mean, he created a new art form basically as a side gig to his job doing newspaper cartoons.
One of the things you bring out in the book is that he consistently believe that animation should be a museum-level art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if he talked about that, there are a lot of quotes from him about that. He would give speeches and lectures, and he was like, you know, someday we will see this in museums. Instead of going to see paintings, you know, oil paintings on canvases, we'll see these drawings that moved. I mean, he had this vision. That was his vision for it. And a lot of the art that he did put out, like, for instance, The Sinking of Lusitania, he had this idea before World War One. People didn't see this. We weren't able to record it. So he imagined what it would have been like and did this really moving, artful cartoon about it. But then later he watched as the industry, you know, turned more towards comedy and gags and things like that. Those were really funny and they operated on a very high level, but a lot of stuff he didn't really like. And he condemned it and he was very critical of a lot of the people that came after him.
One of his first great animations, Gertie the Dinosaur, he actually act on stage with the animation in sort of the background.
Right. Yeah, and in the book we talk about the golden age of animation. And I use that term because there were no rules back then. Nobody had done this stuff. Everyone was doing it for the first time, especially Winsor. So they're creating the vocabulary, they're creating the format. And when he started doing it, it's like, well, you know, like there was nothing else to base his work on. So he created this cartoon, Gertie the Dinosaur, and he'd go on vaudeville stages and perform alongside of it because it was like, well, why not? And then you're in this moment, too, where cinema is just being invented. And so you've got the stage world and you've got this new movie world, and he combined the two. So he's bridging these two different, really three different art forms.
The sad thing about Winsor McKay is he ended up at a Hearst newspaper. Working for what, Arthur Brisbane, who sounds like a nightmare. It just sounds like a total Nimrod.
Right. He was today, Arthur Brisbane was a pundit who was kind of like, I think in the book I say, you know, he's like an overheated cable news pundit. I mean, someone who is out being very sensational. He's stoking the fires, you know, culture wars. He's very bombastic, you know. And McKay, who did very elegant kind of, you know, work that you'd explore the psychology of dreams and all this stuff. One day he's assigned basically to work for Arthur Brisbane, and he's got to do illustrations and cartoons for this guy's just bombastic, you know, opinions. And he struggled for a really long time, and he made tons of money. That's funny. Like, in 1907 or thereabouts, Winsor McKay was making $50,000 a year.
Wow.
A princely sum.
It is. Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful house, you know, chauffeur-driven cars. It was very different in those days, being a newspaper cartoonist, especially at the high level McKay was. And so here you have this artist who is celebrated for this very thoughtful, sophisticated art. And for a while, you know, partly because he was good, but also to rein him in, Hearst had him assigned to this guy, Brisbane. And he's got to illustrate just this man's anger, basically. And on the side, he's animating and creating this new art form. But it was a bit of a struggle for him.
Well, Hearst didn't want him to do it. Hearst didn't feel it was seemly for his cartoonists to be out there on the stage.
Right. And partly it's because he thought it distracted from his work being a newspaper cartoonist. And, you know, back then, people would buy. You'd see circulation going up just because of the cartoons. It was a big deal. And Hearst, very early on, had started International Film Service. He'd started an animation studio in the 19-teens, really just as a way to promote his newspaper cartoons. He thought people would go into movie theaters, and then they would see them up on the screen, and then they'd buy more papers. He later realized that it was very expensive to run an animation studio, and he just started, you know, outsourcing that work. But he looked at McKay. He was like, you know, you're doing this thing off on the side, but you're real value to me, and I pay you a lot of money is to do these newspaper cartoons, and told him, you can't do it. You can't tour around with Gertie. You can't. And he later relaxed that, but he kept it and you know, a grip around him. I didn't put this in the book. There was an episode where Hearst had McKay come out to San Simeon, his big estate in California, and where he had a zoo and everything. And McKay spent a week just kind of wandering around. He only saw Hearst once.
Whoa.
He only saw Hearst once.
So he's just having him there, like, on his own?
Just kind of had him there because it was talent that he basically owned. And it's funny because
one of Hearst's
servants came out, and McKay asked him, you know, can you get me some booze? Can you get me some alcohol? And the servant was like, well, I was told you weren't supposed to, you didn't drink. And he's like, oh, no, I drink. Can you just bring me something? The servant shows up with a case of gin, the whole case. He's like, here you go. So he spends a week at Hearst's castle just drinking his way through a case of gin, sort of wondering, why am I here?
Oh, my God. Well, that's one of the weirdest stories. And we're not sure this is true, I guess. In the fall of 1927, 30 animators met at Roth's in New York City, which is a swanky hotel, just as sort of a celebration of what they achieved. And McKay is like sort of the keynote speaker because he's the grandfather. He's the one who set the tone. And they decided to show this film called Ever Ready, Heart On, in Buried Treasure. Now, when you wrote about it, I had to go to YouTube and watch it. I had never seen it before. It is absolutely filthy.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the dirtiest things you've ever seen. And McKay,
so they show this. I just can't imagine this. Here's Winsor McKay, who wants animation to be a museum level art, and they show this movie.
Yeah, and so I hesitate to even describe that on the radio. You know,
less, oh, don't, the, yeah, don't.
You
can't do that.
Less listeners' ears start to burn, but it is fully pornographic to the level of, it was rumored that because it was so lewd and bawdy and so graphic, they couldn't even develop the film in the United States. They had to send it to Cuba to even get it developed so that they could skirt, you know, the blue laws and that sort of thing.
The most bizarre thing about it is that it's like this Farmer Brown level of animation. So it's just like, but it's doing the most incredibly rude things. And so then Winsor McKay gets up to talk. And initially he's doing this dry thing about how animation is made. And then he just goes into this harangue about the importance of the artistry of it, and he ends up cursing them out. He just wishes them essentially bad luck at the end.
Yeah, there are very few accounts of this sort of, you know, famous in the lore meeting, and he could tell that he's losing the room. Like he had been out of animation. He was off doing his own thing. He was sort of out of touch, but they all looked at him like the god of this art form. He was a guest of honor. And he's giving this dry speech, and he sees that he's losing the room. And so then he just kind of goes off on a little bit of this tirade. And he wasn't an angry kind of guy, but he was just kind of lecturing him like, look, I envision this as a great art form. And look what you people have done to it. It's just a bunch of, like, slapping each other on the butts with sticks kind of jokes, just a lot of kind of gags. And the room just sat there, having been chastised, kind of ready to move on. You know, like, they're looking at their hero, and their hero's telling them, you guys aren't very good.
And he does wish them bad luck.
Yeah, and it came up in a weird way, too. The quote's in the book, but he's like, and he's going off, and it's kind of hard to follow exactly what he's saying. And then it's like, and bad luck. Almost like he's cursing them. It's like, you ruined this art form that I created. Now I'm cursing you. And bad luck.
And he drops. I can just imagine dropping the mic. Bang.
Yeah. One of the accounts was from a cartoonist who later went on to draw for The New Yorker. And he was like, we were just sitting there like, huh.
Wow.
What is going on?
Now, the additive inverse, the antimatter to his Windsor McKay's matter has got to be Paul Terry, because basically Paul Terry, from the get-go, through his entire career, looked at cartoons as nothing more than a commodity.
Right. He had this one brief moment at the very beginning where it's like, yeah, he was going off in this other page making cartoons, but he just, you know, he was told by theater owners, I show your work to kind of clear out the seats after a show so that I can get, like, you know, and it's something in his brain just kind of snapped, and it was, you know what, it's just a business to me. And he made cartoons that were pretty bad. I mean, he was making stuff that kind of gave cartoons a bad name. A lot of people thought that they were juvenile, and it was just kind of a novelty, and that they were soon going to go away and wouldn't even exist anymore. And they're looking at Paul Terry's cartoons, which weren't great. They weren't that sophisticated, but they made a ton of money for him. He did them really cheaply. He did them really fast. And I probably can't use the quote on the radio.
What, we do shit here?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I mean, I can't. He told somebody who was applying to work there, and he went on and on. That's what we do. We just do shit.
Yeah, if you can't make shit, then don't work here.
Oh,
if you don't
want
to make shit, then don't work here. But he made a ton of money.
Now,
all these other, like Disney is a great example of someone who his films made a lot of money, but his films also cost a lot of money. So his studio was always, you know, kind of struggling in a lot of ways financially. And there are a lot of reasons for that I get into in the book. But with Terry, he just did them on these shoestring budgets. And it was like owning a small factory. And he just turned these things out. And for himself, not for his animators, but for himself, he made a lot of dough.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is author Reed Mittenbuehler. And we're talking about his latest book. It is so entertaining. Wild Minds, The Artists and Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation. And rivalries is really true. One of the rivalries that runs the entire length of the book is the Fleischer Brothers and Disney. And I don't want to give away the ending of the book, because I think the ending of the book is so perfect. But Fleischer was always trying to catch up to Disney. Now, that's them. And then another interesting rivalry was Warner Brothers animators, who basically put a pox on both of them and sort of said, like, we're the teenager, you know, upstarts, and we're going to do the crazy stuff. And then finally you got the UPA animators who said, you're all, you know, lowbrow, and we're going to do the highbrow stuff, guys. And it's interesting to look at the history of American animation in terms of rivalries. And I want to talk about the Fleischer brothers, Max and Dave. Some of their origins of their earliest stuff is really weird. They originally did they first of all invented the technique rotoscoping. Talk about what that is.
Right. So Max Fleischer, you know, he had an engineering brain. He had an artistic brain. He was a really good artist, but he was really into mechanics. And in the very early days of animation, the quality wasn't great. The images would be a little blurry and blotchy, you know, and people were trying to figure it out still. And Max Fleischer invented this device called the rotoscope, and it basically allowed you to film somebody or something And then it would project that image onto a piece of glass so that an animator could then trace it for more lifelike movement. And you can see this used in some of their films, especially their later films, like Gulliver's Travels. And Disney used this a little bit for, you know, Snow White. A lot of animators later moved away from the rotoscope because it was realistic. And the advantage that animation has over live action is that it takes you out of reality.
Right,
it takes you into these surreal, fantastical places. And a lot of animators later were like, well, the rotoscope, yeah, we could do things realistically, but we're also doing, you know, talking animals and all kinds of crazy stuff. And we should just do that out of our minds, out of our, you know, and kind of we can get to reality better with a fiction than we sometimes can being realistic using this device. So it had its place and helped revolutionize animation in the early days. You know, it helped really improve the technical craft of it. But it was also a little controversial among some animators because they're like, well, we're supposed to be doing crazy stuff that isn't realistic.
Yeah.
So why do we need this device?
What were the origins of Coco the Clown?
Well, Coco the Clown, so Dave Fleischer, the brother, in the very early days of animation, they're trying to figure out their character, you know? Like, we need to have a character. And, you know, you have Felix the Cat, who's really the first big cartoon star in the Jazz Age. And the first film that he appeared in, he wasn't even called Felix then. It was in 1919. And so they're like, okay, we need our character. And Dave Fleischer had worked as a clown on the boardwalk in Coney Island when he was younger. And he would dress up in this clown suit, and he would go around basically pranking people. Like, he had this like electrically charged whip that he'd go after women with, or they'd drill holes in the bottom of the boardwalk so that when women walked by, it would blow their dresses up. I mean, all kinds of cruel, you know, pranks. And so, you know, they're trying to find a character, and they're like, why don't we resurrect the clown? So Dave goes to the closet and drags out this old clown suit, which was black with these big white buttons that would show up really easily on film. And it was baggy, so it'd be kind of easier to trace because they were using the rotoscope. And they created this character. And in the early Coco cartoons, it's a mix of live action and animation. You go out him, you'll see Max Fleischer, and you know, he's the creator. And he's creating the clown, and the clown comes out of the page, and they interact, and they run around, and they do all kinds of crazy stuff together. Those are the origins of...
And that becomes the Out of the Inkwell series.
Yes, Out of the Inkwell series, yes.
The weird thing is that they had their moment when they tried to make a serious animation. In 1923, they make Einstein's Theory of Relativity, an animation.
Right, and Einstein liked it. Einstein had seen it and was very complimentary of it. So Max Fleischer, he had worked for he had worked for science magazines, worked for the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. He did a lot of science stuff when he was younger, science illustrations. And he had, you know, a science mind. He had also done a cartoon a little bit later about the theory of evolution. He was inspired by the Scopes Monkey Trial. So there was a moment for him where it wasn't just about comedy. It wasn't just about totally entertaining people. But he was like, we can use animation to educate a little bit too. But those films that they did, you know, like the Theory of Relativity film by Einstein and the evolution film, they didn't do very well. And it would be very controversial, especially the evolution one. There were riots the night that it showed.
Jesus. They were
at the American Museum of Natural History. And there's some funny quotes in the book from Max where he talks about that. And it's like, yeah, he kind of learned real fast. It was about entertaining people. And so he had these high-minded ideals kind of in the same way that Winsor McCay did. But also, you know, realized he was in business and that entertainment paid the bills a little bit better.
And he starts doing the Tar Cartoons series when sound comes. And that was a big moment when sound came into animation.
Yeah, the thing that really fascinated me most about sound, and this is a story that, you know, surprised me as I really started to dig into it, is that animation almost ceased to exist by the end of the late 90s. People didn't really like it. They saw it just as this kind of novelty, and we're not really into cartoons. You know, they didn't really like them. They were seen as juvenile. And then sound comes into play. And a lot of the big studios, which had gotten rid of their animation departments just because they didn't think it was worth it, all of a sudden realized a lot of these studios, they owned music catalogs, music publishing businesses. So they had the rights to all of these songs, pop songs. And so they realized, well, if we have an animation department and we require them to use one or two of these songs in every cartoon, it's a way to cross-promote. We can earn ancillary income, and it'll help make these songs popular. So they really didn't care what animators did. But it was, as long as you get a couple of our songs into this thing so we can promote them, you can kind of do whatever. So you've got this form now, animation, especially, you know, with the Fleischers. And the Fleischers work with Paramount, and Paramount owns a lot of music. They kind of do whatever they want. They could be wildly experimental, as long as they got a couple of those songs in there. And the Fleischers, for their part, they were pretty friendly with Cab Calloway. And so they're working a lot with jazz. And jazz at this time in history, it's subversive. It's kind of the way hip-hop was in the 1980s. And people think it's a little bit scary. And people aren't quite sure what to think about it. And they're promoting these artists. If you look at Betty Boop and Snow White, and they're playing St. James Infirmary Blues, and Cab Calloway is doing his kind of moonwalk dance. Yeah, it's a very surreal, weird, spooky, beautiful.
And their cast of musicians that appeared in their animations is amazing. Louis Armstrong was in there. The Angry Samoans were in one of them. Now, Betty Boop is really a fascinating, because she ends up capturing the minds of the early 30s, whereas Felix the Cat was really, you know, a 20s character, and he didn't translate well into the 30s.
He just didn't. You know, it's like all stars, right? You have your moment in the sun. So you've got Felix the Cat, which translates perfectly to the jazz age. Felix is out there just doing wild, crazy things. He's pulling off his tail, and he's using...
He was not a nice guy. He was sort of a prank.
He's not a nice guy. And you see death and destruction. You know, later in cartoons, you'd never see a cartoon character actually die. You know, they TNT can explode in their face, or an anvil falls on them, or whatever it is, but they would always kind of bounce back. But in some old Felix cartoons, you'd see battle and war. Its creator, Otto Mesmer, had seen a lot of very serious action in World War One, and the creator, you know, he would show, you know, there's this one cartoon where cats declare war on rats, and Felix is enlisted into the fight, and you'll see X's for eyes when they die. When they die, they stay dead. But also the cartoon, he was surreal and imaginative in this very roaring 20s jazz age kind of way. And then sound comes, and it just didn't really translate. The popularity of the cartoon character had already been fading. I say in the book, you know, when they tried to add sound to the Felix cartoons, so they didn't do very well. It was like trying to add the wrong kind of blood type to a patient who's having surgery. Yeah. It just didn't work. It didn't sound right. And then the character was always kind of already kind of on his way out. And then the next real big star to replace them, we have Mickey Mouse, obviously, but on the Fleischer side, you've got Betty Boop. And Betty Boop comes into play, you know, right around when the Depression is starting. And she kind of reminded Americans in a lot of ways of kind of what they had just left. But what was really interesting to me about her is in those early days, she's very sexualized. She's got these big curves, and it's very... And then the Hayes Code comes in.
Well, wait a minute. Before the Hayes Code is one of the weirdest moments in the history of animation, there's Betty Boop on trial. Helen Kane, Helen Kane brings Betty Boop to an actual legal procedure. And it was actually referred to as the Boop Boop a Doopery trial.
Right. So it's funny. So Betty Boop is created at the Fleischer studio. And there was this question about where the inspiration came from. And you've got this singer, Helen Kane, and she had been quite a popular star in the Paramount system. And if you look at her, she looks like Betty. I mean,
you have a photograph of her in the book. She looks like Betty Boop.
Yeah, there's a photograph of her in the book. And if you hear her talk and you hear her, it's like, okay, you see a lot of comparison. And so that was also a popular singing style. So she sued, basically. And then her career had hit a bad patch at this point. She had been a big star, you know, pretty big, on her way up. Career had hit this bad patch, and so she sued. And there was this trial in New York. And it was covered pretty widely, so I had a lot of really interesting sources to draw on, you know, as I'm recreating these scenes. But you've got this judge who had kind of come up through the Tammany Hall system. You know, this is still like old New York. And they're talking about this, and Max Fleischer, it's going to ruin a studio, basically, if he loses. and they're going back and forth trying to determine, trying to get to the bottom of it. Like, where did this character come from? Did you steal the image of, you know, did you go back and forth? But you've got lawyers in the case arguing, but they're trying to recreate the music. So it's like they're singing boop, boop, a doop, but they're doing it all these different ways. And the reporters reporting on it don't really take it seriously because it's just like cartoons. So they're calling it the boops heard around the world, and they're making fun. And Helen Kane, unfortunately, had gained a lot of weight. And that's part of the reason that the studios had, you know, been casting her as much. And, you know, they're saying kind of mean things about her in the papers, like, oh, she's got the voice of an indignant doll, like that
kind of thing. Oh, wow.
And they're just, going up. And so they're just watching cartoons in this courtroom, and the trial lasted a while. And lawyers arguing back and forth. And ultimately, they determined that he hadn't stolen, you know, the idea that it was going around too much. And how can you copyright gibberish? You know, they're saying boop-boop-a-doop. How can you? And then even Helen Kane's later husband, she'd gotten remarried, defended the decision. You know, like even Shakespeare did that with Hey Nonny Nonny. You really can't copyright gibberish.
Oh, wow. And then, as you mentioned, the Hays Code comes in. And that's, you know, Betty Boop post-Hays Code is just not the same Betty Boop.
No. And so the Hays Code is this self-inflicted, really, code that Hollywood put in place. So that they were worried that they were going to be censored, that the federal government was going to step in the same way they had done for alcohol.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Reed, we're going to have to end it there. We've run out of time. And we've only talked about Betty Boop. We haven't even talked about Popeye. But I'm going to have you back because there's so much more to talk about in this book. My guest tonight is author Reed Mittenbuehler, and we've been talking about his latest book. There's so much great stuff in it. Wild Minds, The Artists and Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation. Reed, it's been a real pleasure.
It's been a pleasure coming on. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.